Okay, real talk. When did paying someone back become social media?
What do you mean?
Like, say I want to see what you're doing and who you're hanging with, and you're not posting about it on your story. I can just stalk your pay app and find out what you're doing.
Oh, yeah, that's weird. You do that?
No, I don't do that. I use Apple Cash. It's built into your iPhone, easy and secure. You can send and receive money right in messages and keep it between friends, and then use that money to buy something at a store with Apple Pay.
Did you just pay me a dollar on Apple Cash?
Maybe.
Shh.
Services are provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Terms apply.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, this is Annie.
It's Mitha.
And welcome to Steph on Never Told You, production of iHeartRadio. And as promised, here's our part two of our two-part episode on Leah Thomas's recently published book, The Intersectional Environmentalist. If you haven't checked it out, our part one on it, go do so. And also, if you haven't checked out the book, go do so.
Yes.
Because it's really, really excellently written. It's so important. And it's such a good look at why the issues of the environment have to be intersectional. We have to look at them through an intersectional lens. So it's just can't recommend it enough. And yeah, this is, as we were publishing this is Earth Day, Earth Month, perhaps. And you might notice that Samantha sounds a little different.
Because Earth and I are one.
The Sorry. Earth is not happy with you, perhaps.
It has decided to, inundate me with all of the particles of the Earth, as happens in Atlanta, Georgia. And yes, everything is watering out of my
That's
face.
Fun.
You're welcome.
It's a fun description.
That's the best way I can do it. And it's not COVID. I have taken 3 tests. And they've all said no. So either it's lying to me, which I know can't happen, but I do have my sense of taste and smell still, as well as the fact that I don't really have a sore throat. So I guess that's good news.
I think it's, I mean, yes, I would say it falls under the category of good news.
Yes.
Yes, but it's definitely a high allergy city, Atlanta.
Everything is yellow.
Everything's yellow. The dogwood smell is out. Full force. I forget about it every spring, and then I go outside. And
it slaps you in the face, right? Literally, like, hey, we're
here.
Oh
my goodness! Yes. Oh yes, I forgot about this. So, with that being said, let's jump right in. But again, if you haven't listened to part one, we suggest you do that first because we covered a lot of the foundation from the book in that one. For this one, we're going to start with environmental justice, that theme. Here's a quote. What's often left out of environmental history and education is how people of color have always been at the forefront of community advocacy. Even if they weren't as present at the first Earth Day or aren't as often seen summiting mountains in a national park, Black, Indigenous, and other communities of color are a part of environmental history in other very important ways. Whether it's activism for Indigenous sovereignty or Black and Brown communities confronting environmental hazards, there's a rich history of BIPOC environmental advocacy and a centuries-long legacy of fighting for justice. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency defines environmental justice as, quote, the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of all people regardless of race, color, national origin, or income with respect to the development, implementation, and enforcement of environmental laws, regulations, and policies. The term environmental justice began to emerge in the 1980s after both the civil rights and Earth Day movements. Soon, environmental justice became a movement of its own. We can turn to the mother and father of environmental justice to get started, Hazel M. Johnson and Dr. Robert Bullard. Hazel M. Johnson was a Black environmental activist from the South Side of Chicago, Illinois. After her husband passed away from lung cancer at the young age of 41, Johnson began to suspect an environmental connection. In a short span of time following her husband's death in 1969, several others within her community, Altgeld Gardens, died from lung cancer. When a news report announced that Altgeld Gardens had some of the highest rates of cancer in all of Chicago, Johnson began to ask herself, why would Altgeld Gardens, a community initially built for Black World War II veterans, have such abnormally high instances of cancer? When investigating the differences between primarily Black Altgeld Gardens and other Chicago neighborhoods, Johnson found that Altgeld Gardens bore a tremendously disproportionate environmental hazard burden. So that's a really long quote, but I think it's so important when we're talking about, because in the part one, we talked about education and how it doesn't showcase people of color, even though they've been doing this work, and then not seeing themselves in that space. And this kind of erasure of the people who have been at the forefront of these movements. And I think this is something, unfortunately, we've seen multiple times with these like environmental hazards in communities that are less well-off, people of color, all kinds of things. And that's part of that intersectionality we're talking about and why it's so important in this conversation.
Right. And I think it's very interesting that we talk about, yeah, at the beginning, the first Earth Day did not really include those marginalized communities. And it's seemingly ironic, I think, because those Earth Day happenings was such a posh idea. And so many upper-class white people came in with like, yeah, let me have the T-shirt that says I love the earth and hug the earth. And, you know, the jokes about tree hugging and all of that came about and became almost a joke when the marginalized communities were so affected that it was a violence within that community, actually killing people, actually making people sick and no one really recognizing it. And because when you are in the higher class of people, I'll put that in quotes, meaning this as a derogatory way, it was far-fetched for them because they didn't see the imminent impact of it, as where those that are marginalized and lower socioeconomic class were truly affected on a daily basis, whether it's because they got sick, because they didn't have the water, they were getting land taken away from them, any of those things that they have been on the forefront, but looking like they're radicals because they're trying to stop something immediately. If not, people are going to die. People of their community were dying. And it's this example is a prime example of those dying immediate at that point in time. And it wasn't something in the far future. We need to make it better for our kids. This whole thing, which is true, we do. We do need to make it better for the future generations, but it's killing people now. And there's this conversation of ignoring that. The fact that Secretary of State Deb Haaland was so fiercely opposed by those making money off of those marginalized communities who were killing off the earth and killing off the people of that land says a lot about what we see as valuable and what we see, who we see as dismissible. And that, again, is why when we talk about intersectional environmentalism, this is not about just looking cute and doing a trend. This is trying to save their own lives.
Yeah. And I think that's a great point that you bring up because I feel like a lot of times these conversations around sustainability, it's easier for people to be like, well, that's, you know, I don't have to deal with it now. That might happen in the future. It might not, but it is happening now and people are dying from it now and they are being hurt from it right now. And they have been for a long time. And then just something I was thinking about the other day, because there's just been a struggle with, you know, mental health for a lot of people during this pandemic. And I had a friend who we were talking about it. And it just occurred to me that some of the, like, you know, we talked about this in a recent episode. Some of the advice you hear all the time is so privileged without seeming to realize that it is. But one of them is like, you know, go outside, go for a walk. And I'm like, that's great if you have access to like a safe place to walk, whether it's like sidewalks or, yeah, just general safety and walking about. but not everybody has that.
Right, right. There are so many mm-hmm. things that are layered that seem so easy for those who are privileged. And again, mm-hmm. this is the comment about being privileged. And I think that's an even bigger conversation when we talk about this whole environmental doomism that's happening right now. And just as a reminder, people have been living in this doom idea, but they've been pushing and they've been trying to make a difference. When we talk about, like, Keystone is a prime example because it actually got some traction, because we know they're still protesting in that mm-hmm. area. We know it's still happening. We know people were being unfairly, unjustly arrested and pushed out. And it's a constant conversation. And then it's become sensationalized in the conspiracy theory types of movies that become entertainment. And so therefore becomes fictionalized. And I hate that. I hate that this is what's happening. Mm-hmm. But also trying to bring awareness. It's just this fine line. But the fact of the matter is, when we have privileged people saying, oh no, it's over, just quit, that means you're not truly affected. If you really think you can quit, then you've not been truly affected, and we need to do more. And I say, not you, we need to do more, because that type of attitude already puts those people who could actually make some help and make some change and showing, again, their privilege that they can quit.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
But moving on, she continues on saying, while some may have overlooked the increased placement of toxic waste facilities in Black communities and deemed the occurrence coincidental, Johnson fought her entire career to prove that it was intentional. All across the United States, Black and low-income communities were plagued with environmental hazards that impact the health of residents and often resulted in illness, worsened quality of life, and death. Johnson fought for legislators and community members to recognize the racism at play and its serious consequences on health and the environment. She said, quote, for so long, environmental activism has been primarily a white middle class issue, far removed from the daily reality of inner city life. Johnson told the Chicago Tribune in 1955. It's all very well to embrace saving the rainforest and conserving endangered animal species, but such global initiatives don't even begin to impact communities inhabited by people of color. And yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about. This whole idea that it's a far removed ideal situation, as if something is not really happening. It shows your privilege that you don't understand that it's happening right here. When you look at the drinking water, when you talk about what's accessible, what's not accessible, when you talk about air quality and why that is a danger. And yeah, who is doing the runoffs in what area? So when we see big industries doing runoffs into highly urban populations, you're like, yeah, that is absolutely affecting them and no one's actually testing it. And as we know, as many administrations before, even this administration, they're overlooking that to make the money, which is such a BS way of being. I'm trying to make this family friendly.
That's what we strive for. That's what we strive for. Yeah, yeah. And I think that there are a lot of as we said in part one, one of the things that I love so much about this book is it provides resources and like other things to look up after you've read it, and like things to educate yourself on and ways you can be active in this field. But I also like there's chapter like near the end, and we're going to talk about it a little bit later, but there's sort of this like, yes, these big companies are doing this and it can feel like you don't have any impact, but here are industries where you can. And like one was fast fashion and stuff like that. And sort of being aware of all that goes into those things. And again, there's still an accessibility issue and price point issue with all of this stuff. But I appreciated that. That's mm-hmm. okay. Mm-hmm. I know now I'm armed with more intelligence, more knowledge.
Knowledge.
Yes, yes, which we love. Here's another quote. Shortly after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke to the Memphis sanitation strikers in 1968, he was assassinated. This was a national tragedy, and it was also a major setback for environmental justice. Just as civil rights activists had begun to speak up against environmental injustices, a beloved leader was lost, followed by several other prominent Black leaders. As many civil rights activists and Black citizens grieved, a largely white environmental movement began to sweep the United States. These environmentalists took note of the tactics used by civil rights protesters like sit-ins and marches and began to use those strategies to spread awareness about conservation, pollution, toxic waste, and more. The movement finally ignited in 1969 when disturbing images of Cleveland, Ohio's Cuyahoga River engulfed in flames, yes, a body of water with fire raging on top of it, were published in Time magazine. The United States was shocked and wanted to know more. The river fire, caused by extremely flammable oil, gas, and toxic waste dumped into waterways, was far more anomalous during this time period. But with this one article, the nation came face to face with what a world on fire could look like if policies didn't adequately protect the planet. In response, millions took to the streets, protesting and pressuring politicians to implement federal environmental policies. This collective action led to the largest environmental demonstration in history on April 22, 1970, Earth Day, in which 20 million Americans called for a drastic improvement in environmental policy. The first Earth Day was a spectacular feat, with gatherings and activities across the world. However, even though it was inspired by and occurred in close proximity with the civil rights movement and civil rights efforts of Chicano and indigenous activists, it was largely white-led and attended, which brings us to the question, what is the impact of having large-scale environmental movements that mostly exclude the voices of the underrepresented and people of color? Yeah. Again, I just think this is so important, all of this context and history that Thomas provides in this book and how it is such an intersectional issue and why it is very, very important that it remains that we look at it that way. And if you haven't listened to part one or read the book or seen Leah Thomas about online, she did coin the term intersectional environmentalist. So this is like, she is doing the work here. She has been doing the work. And I just think she did such a great job on like tying all of these things together and showing why they're all connected.
Right.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And I do love her conversation about excluding the marginalized community, the indigenous and the Chicano community, as well as obviously the Black community. And it kind of reminds me of the fact that the young people who have come up and rose in conversation, you know, we have this whole thing with adult politicians making fun of young activists who were really trying to make an effort. That's a whole different conversation. You're like, why are you demeaning what's happening here? It's a serious conversation. And you're acting like a child by demeaning a child. But mm-hmm. I digress. But the fact of the matter is that we know Greta Thunberg, she kind of became a symbol for those young people. And the one famous picture that I remember is her and all the activists, and two of the young Black women were cut out, or women of color were cut out of the picture. And I'm like, whoa, that says so much to what is happening here. And I know the other one of the ones that were cut out was Vanessa Nakate, who is now a little more well-known because of that incident, calling them out. I'm like, wait, I'm here too. I've been doing the work as well. I don't understand why I just got cut out. But it's very telling of what is being shown, what is being talked about, who is being recognized. I mean, even Flint, Michigan's own activist, Mari Kopany, came about and has been a part of this work as well and still is doing this work. I think she's like 18 now and really pushing forward with the conversations. She raised money to get bottled water because of the water situation that was still going bad. I don't think it's fully fixed even today, and no one's looking at it. And we barely see mention of her outside of what other activists are talked about too. We follow her and we know she does an amazing job and she is doing that work. But I'm like, you're a kid. Bless your heart that you have to put this on your own shoulder. And now you've become the face of this. And again, had to go under some scrutiny about the fact that she was speaking out about it and that she had to be the one to speak out about it, that she had to do fundraising instead of having the government supply as they should be taking care of their own people. So there's so many conversations about who is the face, who is being recognized, and who is actually being listened to. And the fact that we know Greta, who is an amazing worker, and I don't want to take that away from her because she's doing amazing work and proud to see it, but she also has the privilege of being supported by her community, her country, and doing all these things, even though she goes under ridicule from other adults. But the fact that she is getting all the accolades when so many others have been there with her, it's seemingly like there's enough roses to give out. There's enough credits to give out. Let's do that. Let's mm-hmm. talk about that and talk about those works as well mm-hmm. and quit making it seem like it's only privileged white people who are doing this, because it's yes. not. It mm-hmm. is not. So we keep going in her book, and she says, although the Earth Day movement led to the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency and the passage of several prominent federal environmental laws like the Clean Air Act or the CAA and the Clean Water Act, it can be argued that these laws do not equally protect all Americans. While primarily white communities in the U.S. saw a 70% reduction in air pollution after the CAA was passed, low-income and Black, Indigenous, Asian, Pacific Islander, and Latinx communities were seemingly left out of the parameters of protection outlined in these laws. In fact, some of the environmental legislation passed in the 1970s directly diverted toxic waste into Black, brown, and low-income communities. This exclusion and unethical treatment led to the emergence of the environmental justice movement in the 1980s. And that's exactly what I was talking about earlier, how it went from, okay, these industries decided to pull and reroute to here. And no one really seeing where it went, just, oh, it was fixed over here, so I'm going to be quiet.
Right. And there are so many parts of this book where it was hard not to just quote the entire thing, because you know we love some good data and numbers. And Leah Thomas like really lays it out to back up this point. So the numbers are really stark and really quite awful.
Right.
But here's a quote. Startlingly, as of 2019, race is still the number one indicator of where toxic waste facilities are located in the U.S. According to Paul Mohai, an environmental justice expert and professor at the University of Michigan, even when socioeconomic factors are similar across white and non-white communities, the community of color is still more likely to be near environmental hazards. The fight for environmental justice remains urgent, even more so as we face the climate crisis.
Right. I think once again, when we have a conversation about who gets good drinking water, who gets access to drinking water, drinkable water, we know where it starts. When we talk about power outages, it's obvious who is prioritized and what is prioritized when you see grids. I think Texas had a huge understanding and saw that very quickly. Of course, Texas is privatized. From what I'm aware, a lot of states are privatized and we just didn't know it or didn't understand it. So that's a whole different conversation in itself. But yeah, Texas became a glaring obviousness of like, hey, we know who they're prioritizing and you are not it. If you are in the low income area, you are not the one. So it's an obvious line. And there are moments when in crisis, you see who is being prioritized and who is seen as important and who is seen as dismissed or erasable.
Yeah. And that's throughout the book. Thomas gives examples of that as well. And, you know, when you think of terms like Flint, Michigan or Katrina, it's very clear who is being prioritized.
Right. And we're moving on. It says, history often repeats itself and large civil rights and climate movements have emerged again. In 2013, following the 2012 murder of Trayvon Martin, an unarmed Black teenager who was racially profiled and confronted while walking to a family friend's house, activists Alicia Garza, Patrice Cullors, and Opal Tometi created the phrase and hashtag Black Lives Matter. Their campaign grew into a global movement following the deaths of even more unarmed Black men and women killed by excessive force, galvanizing millions of protesters over the years in the largest civil rights movement of the 21st century. Land Back, a movement to reclaim everything stolen from Indigenous peoples, land, language, ceremony, medicines, and kinship, is growing. The Stop Asian Hate movement, sparked by a global increase in discrimination and violence against Asian people, is gaining momentum and resulting in policy shifts such as an anti-Asian hate crimes bill.
Right. So again, just all this intersectionality and why it all matters. And then going on, here's another quote. At the same time, a new generation of climate activists are emerging all across the globe. The Youth Strike for Climate, also known as Fridays for Future, began in 2018 after Swedish youth activist Greta Thunberg staged a protest in front of the Swedish parliament, holding a sign that read, School Strike for Climate. Her actions, along with those of several other brave students, resulted in an international movement of students of various ages that demonstrated and walked out of Friday classes to demand climate action, a transition to renewable energy, and a commitment to stopping the climate crisis. By 2019, over 1 million demonstrators, primarily students across 150 countries, had participated in the protest.
Right. And I'm glad we came back to her in our conversation because it's a huge thing that they have created. And I love these movements. And yeah, as we even talk about in our Women Around the World, we're often talking about the younger generation really spearheading this movement. And I love it. I love it for us. I love to see that it's happening. I'm sad that it's taken this long. But both of those big movements, all these movements are really happening on a whole different scale. I know we can talk about social media being at the forefront of it too, but also that these are amazing women and girls who are creating these movements. And we've talked about it before. It really is a difference when you have these level of activists ready to just stand up and have a conversation. And oftentimes we see that it is squashed or ignored for so long. And when you get enough people, enough attention, that you have to at least have a conversation about it, which is the smallest step that you could truly take. But it's at least beginning something.
Yes. Yes. And one of the other things I really loved about this book is the nuance all these things were given, the nuance that it deserves, because I think a lot of times there's like terms like wish cycling or, you know, like a lot of times we do like one good thing. We're like, I'm doing this for the earth. But you really have to look into that. Like it's way more than just that. And there can be a dark side to some of these things.
Right.
Which we're going to talk about towards the end. But before we get to that, we did want to talk about privilege because there's a whole chapter about that in the book. Here's a quote. We all have parts of our identities that shape how we relate to the world and how the world relates to us. The smallest things, from freckles on our faces to the tones of our voices, can influence how we're perceived by others and ultimately how they might treat us. These personal perceptions can lead to an accumulation of assumptions that become societal perceptions or biases that can be positive, neutral, or negative. Privilege is a set of unearned advantages, positive. Again, that this is just such a huge, important piece of like all conversations, but in this one, and when it comes to environmentalism, as we've just been talking about this whole time, it's you have to acknowledge it. It is so important.
Right. And also where you can do these things. So we talked about activism after the largest typhoon that happened and the people who were trying to really talk about, hey, this is killing our community. Not only is it killing our where we're living, but our way of life. Like fishermen who are trying to make a living, they're dying because they're getting capsized and drowning. Like all of these things. And these are conversations about the way things are built, the types of constructions that are happening, all of these things. And people were being murdered for just saying it. And that's what the biggest thing is, like, for the upper class white citizens, that is not as huge a threat as those indigenous in our communities who have disappeared. They have disappeared in their activism. And it is still happening. There are conversations and questions where we're like, wait, we also know that a lot of indigenous activists have been actually arrested and are still locked up. And there's conversations about that. So that is a privilege, being able to protest without being marked as in being endangered for your protest is a huge privilege. And we see that more often than not, that when they are in these marginalized communities, they are targeted in a dangerous and violent way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big part of that privilege. Mm-hmm. Let's keep talking about it because she talks about it and we need more conversations on it. So Leah says, social constructs are beliefs that members of society hold and assign meaning and value to. For example, a common argument is that race is a social construct. That doesn't mean that there aren't different ethnicities of people, but that assigning value and meaning to a different racial group in a society is a social construct. When people use racism as a justification for the mistreatment of other people, they are playing off a social construct that race inherently makes humans different from one another. When there is no factual or scientific basis for this. Stereotypes are born out of social constructs.
Yep.
I feel like that's pretty self-explanatory.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, has been weaponized against people, which is what we know the white cis heteronormative community are using, saying, you're creating this, not us.
Right.
Which is a different conversation we're not going to get into, but, you know, being aware of that as well. And she continues on, when we hold the belief that anyone can succeed if they just set their mind to it, we also give credence to the flip side of that myth that those who don't succeed aren't, quote, trying hard enough. This places the blame solely on the individuals in need rather than on the system of power supporting the barriers and disadvantages that oppress them, no matter how hard they work or try. And that's the big, like, she does such a great job in breaking that down about what that looks like. That bootstrapping theory should have been dismissed so long ago. Maybe it could have worked for one point in time for the lower middle class, lower class white people. That worked. Mm-hmm. But that still had a system of favor, whether it's someone like them that pulled them up, whether it was a family member that eventually, like, their networking is a whole different conversation. As well as that word oppressed or oppression, someone has to be the one that gains from that. And it's typically always those in power.
Right. And I think this point is so, so important because it's been part of our, like, national mythos for so long, that idea. And now it's kind of been repackaged into, like, you got to hustle, you got to do that hustle, you got to have your side hustle. But there are these systems in place. Like, you can work as hard. I mean, you can have like 3 part-time jobs and not barely make a living. Like, you're working so hard, but there are all of these things, all these obstacles and systems that are preventing you from living a happy, healthy life where you can. Yeah, where you do have room to grow or get whatever job you want or whatever life that you want. It's not just like, oh, you didn't work hard enough. We're so ready to turn it around and blame it on people who are working so hard and like running their bodies into the ground.
And the level of that is that example of having a full-time job, 2 part-time jobs, those things, which I was one of those people And don't get me wrong, I definitely was faring better than most. But the fact of the matter is, I was privileged enough to know people to put me in positions to get those extra jobs, to make that work for myself. But on top of that, I did barely get enough to live on my own. Mm-hmm. This did not push me to be so rich. It literally was, wow, I can actually afford to go and be with my friends today and not have to worry about whether or not this car is going to go through, which I've had many times. Like, that is going to be declined and having that panic attack about being declined. And the way I'm saying this is obviously very privileged because I was single and did not have children to worry for, that I didn't go to a grocery store in hoping that it would clear to buy soup for my family, and or not seeing my family, or trying to figure out how to decide whether we're going to have food or daycare so I can go to these said jobs. There's so many things to this. That's a whole different level of conversation. And for those, I know many of those who are affected by this type of environmental injustices don't have time to advocate for themselves because they're working and can't, and just trying to survive that way in order to get those foods. So they can't be activists for themselves. So there's just a whole line of conversations about who was able to be activists. And that's why we see probably a larger number of very privileged white people being able to do this, because they have the time and they have extra income that they can take time off to do so.
Yeah. And that's part of like the cycle we need to break out of with this, because again, like going back to Leah's point of never seeing anyone like her at these things. But yeah, it's just all, it's all connected.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's another quote. Going back to the earlier statistic of lower funding in BIPOC schools versus primarily white schools, this funding gap also exists in community resources like parks, community gardens, and green spaces, meaning that access to these resources also varies along racial lines. systemic housing discrimination practices like redlining, the refusal to insure mortgages in and near Black neighborhoods have added to the climate burden by siloing communities of color in areas that are more likely to be plagued by environmental injustice. Black and Latinx people in the U.S. experience an, quote, air pollution burden in which they are exposed to 56% and 63% more pollution than is caused by their consumption, and which is linked to higher rates of cardiovascular and respiratory issues. The opposite is true for white Americans who experience a pollution advantage, in which they breathe in 17% less air pollution than they cause. So that's also, yeah, a key part of this too, is that, you know, who's causing the most damage and who's the most impacted.
Right. Well, that's the other part of this, because I think about the Clean Air Act. And one of the things that came out of the Clean Air Act was things like emission testing. Great idea. But as someone who was earning $32,000 a year, trying to live in Atlanta, which the cost of living is significantly higher, that has an emissions test that you have to do. And if you do not pass it, you cannot get a tag for your car and you are penalized beyond whatever. At one point in time, my catalytic converter went out. All of these things are so bad for the environment. I get the air quality, everybody should do their part, but I don't have $1,500, $1,600 to fix my car, but I have to have a car to go to my job. What do I do? There are so many things about who is really punishing more so than anyone else. And if you have a brand new car, you're fine. You're fine for the first 2 or 3 years. Who gets brand new cars? Not those who can't afford it, obviously. So there's just so many conversation about who are they actually making money off of and who is it actually going after? And those are big conversations that we need to have about providing services. And then also talking about public transportation not being accessible to many a people or being really dangerous because people are not really checking in on the safety and the real concerns for those who are using public transport and who has accessibility to it. There's so many conversations to this. And then when we look at it, when you break it down, yes, we want to definitely stop with the cars. Let's get more to public transit. But people are so opposed to it because they're like, it's going to bring in those urban people, which is very coded language, and we know exactly what they mean. And so therefore it cuts access, but then we have more emissions. And the corporations are not even turning an eye when one giant building, one corporation gives so much more, kills off so much more of the quality of air and causing more problems and pollutions, which are most likely going to be in areas that are, again, lower socioeconomic living areas. Because people are like, oh, we don't want to live by this. No one does. But they can't afford to not live there. So who has access? There's so many conversations to this that is completely layered about privilege. But yeah, I really, the Clean Air Act, good intentions for those who can afford it.
Yeah. I mean, it's another example of like clearly didn't ask the people who would be impacted the most. And as we said, we are going to talk some more about some of the things that fall under that as well.
Yes. Going on. In addition to environmental injustices, living sustainably can be a matter of privilege. Single-use items are more expensive and plastic is found at higher rates in communities of color. Living on a plant-based diet and eating regenerative and organically grown products is nearly impossible in a state of food apartheid, in which communities of color are more likely to be found. So when educating others about sustainability, make sure to think about intersectionality and privilege first. Refrain from shaming those who are faced with systemic barriers to living low waste and sustainably. And we had a giant example of that. I think we did an ad read about paper plates. And we got a couple of emails like, hey, how dare you? This is awful for the world or whatever, whatnot. And my first response was, I get what you're saying, but for a lot of those who are working constant jobs, have 3 or 4 children, have constant usage, and this is not as accessible as you think it is. This is a cheap alternative for people trying to save time and trying to have their kids be a part of the family. So when a single mom or a single father or a single parent, a caregiver is there, they're working 2 jobs and they have a 12-year-old sitting in for a couple of hours feeding each other. It's not as easy as you think. And I say this as I would grow up in an area, once again, where we didn't have recyclables, and sure, we wanted to, use replace and such. But when you have four kids trying to do all those dishes, caring for yourselves, trying to care for others, it's a little harder than you think. Mm-hmm. And don't get me wrong. Do I use paper plates? No. But am I privileged enough to have just me, myself, and I as a part of the thing? Yes. Mm-hmm. You may think it's not that hard, but it does build up on time. And there's this level of shaming that we really need to get away from, because that doesn't do what you think it does.
No. And I think that this is such a good reminder of, again, like, nothing is that clear cut.
Right.
Like, nothing in life is that clear cut. There's always right. something to consider, and especially around accessibility, because I've seen similar arguments around, sort of different but related, but around like pre-cut food, and people will be like, well, right. people are so lazy. Like, not everybody, I guess, you know, some people can't right. cut up like time-wise, or maybe they have a disability right. or something. Like, you should just make
stop.
Sure.
let's stop. And that's yeah. that whole conversation about, for those who can't afford it, that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Let's not shame, food shame people. It just got into the last 5 years when people were like, oh, food stamps are for those who really are trying to feed everyone on a budget. And I've already explained this a couple of times. To qualify for a food stamp is pretty difficult. And yeah. to lose it is really easy. Like, I had to mm-hmm. sit with my clients to try to fill these out. And I'm like, what the hell yeah. are these forms? And how quickly you can lose it is so easy. It's so mm-hmm. easy to lose. But all of that to say, it just got to the point that it's like, oh, they don't want just milk and cheese and bread.
Mm-hmm.
You can't right. have, like, just, you can have fruit, but it costs so much that it's right. not cost efficient. Mm-hmm. And then people are shaming people for buying something that's not on the list and having a food stamp card. That's such an odd stance to have against people who have food stamps. Allow them to have a treat. Having ice cream, how dare you? How mm-hmm. dare you? You're on food stamps. What?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's so many levels. And to the fact that finally, I think in the last 5 years, community gardens, farmers markets have been like, oh, it would be nice to be accessible for these fresh fruits and good foods mm-hmm. and actually giving like double the value. Yes, please. Let's do that. That's called caring and actually doing some type of activism.
Right. And we won't get into this now, but that's also related to the fat shaming we see of, oh, well, they eat at McDonald's all the time or whatever it is. But that, again, is a lot of times an affordability, like, what can I right. afford? A time thing, especially if you're working like three jobs. And then we right. have the health crisis, and we, as a country, seem to blame or ready to blame, well, that was on you. You should have right. not
How
just eaten
you?
All that all the time.
Right.
Could be only what they could get their hands on or what right. they could afford.
And that's, mm-hmm. again, I think we need to have a lot more compassion, because I know there's a lot of foodie bloggers, parent bloggers that have all this privilege who do shame mm-hmm. about food and saying, don't feed this to your kids. It's yeah. really, really cute and easy. And if you're able to do that, fantastic. Go you. Mm-hmm. No shame to that. But this shouldn't be the narrative that you put a stance on. You really need to calm down and really think about who you're talking to and yeah. why this could be really, really damaging mm-hmm. In so many ways.
Exactly. Exactly.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver. And this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courtney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Thomas also does a great job. She goes into the history of enslavement and disregarding the lives of Black people and how historically that's we're still seeing that going on and how that is involved in this conversation. Here's another quote. In a 2009 USC study, The Climate Gap, Inequalities and How Climate Change Hurts Americans and How to Close the Gap, researchers found that, quote, African Americans on average emit nearly 20% less greenhouse gases than non-Hispanic whites per capita. Though less responsible for climate change, African Americans are significantly more vulnerable to its effects than non-Hispanic whites. This is a recurring theme we'll see throughout this chapter. Those who are least responsible for the climate crisis are often the most impacted and burdened by it. So yes, again, that, and then there is great numbers breakdown on how environmental injustices impact the Black, Latinx, AAPI, and Indigenous communities, with notes on people with disabilities and queer folks. There's international examples, so like how the U.S. was shipping waste to other countries and how that impacted health, sea level rise, and how that impacts certain countries like way more than other countries. And then, as I mentioned, there is these everyday examples she goes over. So one being fast fashion, the waste involved, the human rights violations, the cost of entry, accessibility for slow fashion. So again, like nothing is clear cut. You can't just say like this is good or bad, but it has all of these pieces and we need to talk about it. Another one is the green energy. The lack of inclusion in decision-making when it comes to Indigenous people, causing harm when not done with intersectionality in mind. So yeah, again, like that sounds great, but we have to talk to the people it's going to impact. We have to involve them in it.
Right.
Because it can, she gives examples of when it's harmed communities.
Right. Also, let's just talk about the fact that it's not affordable. Most of the time, these options are not affordable. And the company's doing this on purpose. We know this. But yeah, when it sounds like a great idea and I want to do it. And in the end, it may save you money. But at the beginning, most people can't afford it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. but this is sort of what I was mentioning earlier, that I feel that a lot of people like to make themselves feel better without doing the research. They're just like, oh, this looks good. Whether on a company level, because companies definitely do it too, or on just our own personal levels.
All right. So she continues and writes, the global transition to green energy should not come at the expense of the safety of indigenous peoples. We urgently need to phase out our reliance on non-renewable resources, and green tech should be highly prioritized as a solution. However, within an intersectional approach to environmentalism, we must acknowledge the dark side of green energy and the harm that these initiatives have caused to marginalized communities. We must also ensure that future projects take the protection of all people into consideration. We don't have to choose between justice for people and the planet. Social justice and a green economy can and should coexist.
Yes.
Enough said.
Yes, 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 yes. And then also another kind of daily example she went over was veganism and plant-based living. And she goes over like the huge environmental impact of eating meat, increase in veganism, but again, like the lack of representation when it comes to people of color.
Right. Today I had an amazing video pop up from an, I believe, a Middle Eastern activist who was talking about the fact that Western culture has kind of demonized veganism in a way that, or sensationalized, one of the two. It's according to who you talk to about veganism, and using tofu as a primary example about the fact that tofu is a classic dish within Asian cultures. I've seen it all throughout, whether it's a part of Korean food, Korean Indian food, but it's just an automatic part of it.
Right.
And it just happens to things like, especially Indian cuisine, leans a little more to vegetarian eating. And the fact that it's just their lifestyle and how the Western culture has taken that and either sensationalized that to a point that it's become so expensive and over the top, and or mocking it, saying it's a frou-frou food, is such an odd stance to take that when I started thinking about it, I was like, yeah, it really is. Had I been raised in Korea, it would have just been naturally a part of all of my dishes, and I would have not thought about it. As in fact, when I eat these Korean dishes, I don't think about it. I just like, oh, this is good. It's just a part of this dish. And coming into the U.S. cultural ideas about this being like, this is for, oh, you're a hippie, or what are these things, or you're trying to do these things. And it's seemingly exotic foods, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And that battle in itself and being like, well, eating tofu, eating no meat one day, it's not that big of a deal. Why do we make it seem like we have fallen into a cultural stance and or a political stance in doing so?
Right.
And it shouldn't be.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely been highly politicized. And I think another great reminder throughout, and then with this as well, is like, you know, kind of well-off white people pretending like there's no history, like they've discovered veganism.
Right.
But there's, like you said, like cultures that this is long been part of their history. People have been doing it forever. So do your research.
Right. And again, representation is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And making sure that we understand, oh yeah, it is a cultural part of this and it's okay. And to give credit to where it came from.
Exactly.
A, B, also understanding not everybody can do this. Again, for still is fresh vegetables for the most part, fresh fruit are expensive and they quickly die, quickly go bad.
Yeah.
I'm
you gotta have a plan in place.
You do. And that's privilege. That's privilege to know that you can get all these things. It was a privilege growing up. My parents would bring me fruit, but it had to be on sale. And I loved it, but also sparsing it out so I didn't just eat it all, but then also didn't wait too long. Such a thing. But for all these things, it is a privilege, and we have to understand that. And this is why canned goods and all that came into play and why we need to talk about, once again, affordability. But go ahead.
Yes, yes. Well, this brings us to our concluding quote. So think about your special skills and apply them to the movements you care about. Even though I'm anxious and don't always feel comfortable holding a megaphone, I have found that writing and digital media are ways for me to contribute my unique skills to environmentalism. Your activism may not look like mine or like the next person's, but all of our strengths are pieces of the puzzle. A mentor of mine once said, "Even the revolution needs accountants." This made me laugh, but it's true. We can each contribute our skills in some way. So I'll leave you with this. I hope you understand how powerful you are. Please do share and amplify the messages you believe the world needs to hear. Take a leap of faith and attend a local protest if you can. Raise your hand to introduce an intersectional perspective where it needs to be heard. Stand up for what's right and don't back down. Even when it's difficult, even when you might feel alone, because trust me, we're out there. There are generations of intersectional environmentalists in the field and a community that's ready to embrace you with support. Together, we can transform the future of environmentalism and, with collective action, spread our message across the globe and change enough hearts and minds to positively alter the future. The future is intersectional.
Point blank.
Yes. Yes. I love that. That was the kind of inspiring message she ends this book with. And then, as we said, there's all these really helpful resources. So we can't recommend it enough. It is really, really great.
Right.
It's really quick read. It's informative. It has those, like we said, kind of like questions to ask yourself and think about, and action items, which I love,
right.
To get involved in a responsible, intersectional, respectful way.
Yes. And this is why we also wanted to put this in our book club, because it is a really good book club read. That it is interactive and you can do discussions, and she has all of the added addendums to it. She brings in so many activists that she knows into the book, bringing quotes and little interviews, and tells you where to follow them. I followed a few and I was like, mm-hmm. wait, we followed a few before realizing they were all connected. I was like, look at that.
Yeah.
Loving it. Mm-hmm. She has an amazing amount of resources. She does a great job in tapping in on the different communities, really making sure that we are appreciating and acknowledging the Indigenous community who have been at the forefront of this conversation, because it has so directly impacted them and continues to harm them today, which we need to keep talking about forever and always.
Mm-hmm.
And she does an amazing job in making it seem attainable. Like, these goals are attainable.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fantastic. Go check it out if you haven't already. In the meantime, as always, if you have a book you would like to suggest, we would love to hear it. You can email us at stuffmediamomstuff@iheartmedia.com. You can find us on Twitter @MomStuffPodcast or on Instagram @StuffOnNeverToldYou. Thanks, as always, to our super producer, Christina.
Thank you.
And thanks to you for listening. Stuff I've Never Told You's production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts on iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We're the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio Season 9.
Love at first listen.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
With new segments, correspondence, and a new sound.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Dura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.